It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. To understand the European debt crisis, it helps to keep track of both the short term and the long term. In the short term, Europeans have agreed on a bailout deal that, among other things, would cut the debts of Greece. It's being held up by the Greek prime minister's plan to hold a referendum on austerity measures. Europeans have told Greece it's got to decide soon if it wants to be part of the eurozone or not.
So here's a longer-term issue. Last week, European leaders asked cash-rich China to help back the European bailout fund. And some economists are seeing that request as a shift in the global economic order. NPR's Frank Langfitt reports from Shanghai.
When French President Nicolas Sarkozy called Chinese President Hu Jintao last week, asking China to pour more money into the EU, it got the attention of a lot of people, among them Arvind Subramanian, a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute of International Economics in Washington. Subramanian says Europe's plea for help illustrates a big change in global relations.
It did not turn to the United States because, it's a sign of U.S. economic weakness. There couldn't be any more dramatic illustration of the shift in world power as that request from the EU to China and not the U.S.
EU officials turned to China because it has more foreign currency reserves than any other country, $3.2 trillion. Subramanian says if the Chinese put more money into the EU, they'll want favors in return.
In principle, the list is pretty open-ended. China could say, take us off the arms embargo list that you put us on after Tiananmen Square, 89. Stop lecturing us about human rights.
Chinese firms have often been accused of dumping products on foreign markets. Beijing could ask the EU to make it harder for its own companies to file trade complaints over the practice. Europe is desperate, but would leaders there weaken the position of their own firms?
The EU, they will feel very difficult to make such a deal.
Gary Liu runs the Financial Research Center at the China-Europe International Business School campus in Shanghai. He says the Chinese are approaching the EU very cautiously. This week, Zhu Guangyao, China's vice finance minister, said it was, quote, too early to discuss more bond purchases. And with Greece's prime minister calling for a referendum on the rescue plan, its future is uncertain.
Politically, in China, it is very risky because if you use their money to buy the European debts and then someday the debt defaults, you get nothing. You will be obviously criticized.
In other words, a debt default could anger the Chinese public. The dominant narrative of the past week has been the EU going hat in hand to a China awash in cash and in control. Patrick Chovanec, who teaches at Tsinghua University's School of Economics and Management in Beijing, offers a different narrative. He says China's currency reserves are so big, it has few other options than to invest in U.S. and European bonds. And propping up the EU is in China's self-interest. The EU buys more products from China than anyone else.
In fact, China is much more like a shopkeeper that keeps on having to allow its customers to run up a tab for fear that if it doesn't, then they'll stop selling and go out of business. So the creditor in this case is just as dependent as the debtor.
Chovanec says the solution is to break that cycle of dependency. He thinks China should let its currency, the yuan, rise significantly. That would make European products cheaper and easier for China's growing middle class to buy. And Chovanec says instead of just lending its reserves back to Europe, China should put them to better use.
And if China wants to do a real favor for Europe, it will use them to generate demand for European goods or make productive investments in Europe that will actually generate jobs and earnings and growth and the things that Europe really needs to grow out of its debt problem.
Of course, such a move would mark a major economic policy shift for China, and there are no signs of that happening anytime soon. Frank Langfitt, NPR News, Shanghai.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Guy Raz.
And I'm Robert Siegel. Now, the biggest book interview that I've ever done, from Fiden Press, which publishes art books, comes just about the biggest book I've ever seen. Weighing in at 18 pounds, measuring 16.5 by 12 5/8 inches, and running nearly 1,000 pages, it is called The Art Museum. It presents the collection of an imaginary museum. It would have to be imaginary because it includes pictures from the great museums, galleries, and even private collections of the world. If this museum were real, there would be hardly any need for another. Amanda Renshaw is the editorial director of Fiden Press and of this project. She joins us from London. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
And why don't you explain the point of this book?
Well, you're right. The Art Museum is an imaginary museum, and it's a museum that appears in a book. and it gives the reader a complete overview of art history from cave paintings to works made in the last decade. And so this is the only place that you can go, the only physical museum that you can go and find this complete overview of art history.
Yes, it is billed as a complete overview of world art explained with visual clarity. It is divided into 25 galleries as opposed to chapters, and each gallery is divided into several rooms, which all told include reproductions of over 2,700 works. I want you to describe the challenge during this 10-year-long project of getting access to and photographing all of them.
About 10 years ago, our publisher suggested that we should imagine an unlimited space and that we had an unlimited budget. Now, what would we put into this museum? It didn't matter how famous the works were, how large, how small, how inaccessible to the public. And so we've spent 10 years with a team of about 100 people, curators, teachers, researchers, editors, to find what we believe to be the most amazing collection that tells you the story of art. For example, Duccio's Maestà, which is a very early 14th century altarpiece, was actually divided up and cut into pieces in the early 18th century. And those different pieces of this altarpiece are spread in Europe, around Europe, in different museums. And what we've done is gathered them together and reconstructed Duccio's altarpiece in this book.
It is such a huge project. When you're telling someone about this, is there ever a page you say, go turn to this gallery in that room and you'll see what I'm talking about?
A great way to see how the book works is if you go to the abstract expressionist rooms.
Okay, hold on. Let me look at these.
Yes. So
there's rooms 372
to
452.
Room 374.
Room 374. Okay. Whoa.
This page shows you the masters of abstract expressionism before they reached the peak of what they were trying to do. The Barnett Newman and the Rothko and the Pollock aren't quite what we think of when we imagine a Pollock or a Barnett Newman or a Rothko. Then as you go into the next room, mm-hmm. 375, there is one quintessential work by each of those masters. And then as you go on into the next room, there are a group of Barnett Newmans together. And then the next room is a group of Pollocks together.
Pollocks together, yes, yes.
And then you even get a corridor of Pollock when you turn over the page.
So you're almost indexing what's to come. The
yes.
The first page teases us.
Gives you an overview.
Billboards, what's coming, yes. This is such a big book. When it's open, it is coffee table size, only if you make sure never to have coffee or do much of anything else with that table. Literally, where is the place for, and where's the market for a book like this at $200 a copy?
I think it's for three different types of people. It's for people who know an enormous amount about art history. It's also for all the millions of people who go to art galleries. And it is also a book for, I think, families. It may be the only art book that you have. It is a resource. You would have it on a shelf. You could put it down on your table and look at it as a group. It's a great sharing exercise. There are many pictures on the page to compare and contrast. And sometimes we also reproduce one work of art over the entire expanse of the page as it's open, the double page as it's open. So you really feel that you can see it properly, look at the detail, and celebrate the enjoyment of it.
Amanda Renshaw, thank you very much for talking with us about the Art Museum.
Thank you.
Amanda Renshaw is editorial director of this huge book called The Art Museum and also of Fiden Press in general.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne. Students are borrowing more money than ever to pay for college. Graduates in 2010 carried 5% more debt than the previous year's graduates. And as NPR's Larry Abramson reports, debt is expected to keep growing.
Last week, we learned that college tuition costs went up around 5%. This week, the Project on Student Debt reports that student borrowing went up at the same rate. Lauren Asher tracks loan amounts for the California nonprofit.
For the class of 2010, about two-thirds of all graduates had loans, and their average debt was $25,250.
The data does not include for-profit schools, where enrollment has been climbing and where loan levels tend to be much higher. Now, you might expect the most expensive schools to have the highest levels of debt, Lauren Asher says that's not necessarily the case.
Even colleges with the same sticker prices and similar student bodies can have very different shares of students with debt and very different average debt for those who borrow.
So a low-cost public school like Alabama A&M produces graduates with an average debt of over $31,000. Spokeswoman Wendy Kobler says it's simply a result of shrinking state funding for this historically black college.
The reduction in state support has significantly impacted the amount of grant and aid that we are able to offer our students.
Meanwhile, the sticker price for Williams College in Massachusetts is around $55,000 a year, but students there only borrow around $8,000 on average. Spokesman Jim Colasar says that's a result of a huge endowment. It's also part of the school's commitment to admit everyone who qualifies, regardless of need.
And the vast majority of the way that need is met is through grant, so that the average grant is, in fact, more than $40,000.
If these numbers are a little overwhelming to you, you're not alone. Families and students get confused by the aid process. Sometimes they choose schools that end up costing them more than they expect, and that leads to more debt. The federal government is trying to clear up the confusion. Raj Date of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau says his agency is teaming up with the Department of Education to clarify confusing terms in financial aid offers.
You might have a loan that is called an institutional loan from one school, and in another school, the exact same loan might be called a private loan, but it's describing the same thing.
The hope is this information will help students avoid a lifetime of debt that cannot be discharged in bankruptcy. The White House is also expanding programs that limit how much of their income students must pay. Date says it's all part of an effort to police the huge amount of debt held by students.
Student lending is a big, big market. It is bigger than the credit card business. It is bigger than the auto finance business. It is something that is between $500 billion and $1 trillion in outstandings.
One big question is, will these numbers continue to grow? Lauren Asher of the Project on Student Debt says the numbers for the class of 2010 could have been worse, but
there were substantial increases in grant aid for students, particularly the federal Pell Grant.
Budget hawks in Congress have given every sign that students cannot expect more aid increases in the future that could make substantial debt the norm for more and more students. Larry Abramson, NPR News, Washington.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Robert Siegel.
And I'm Guy Raz. Groupon, the popular daily deal website, offers discounts on everything from hotel rooms to body waxing. Now, Groupon itself is up for offer. The Chicago-based company is getting ready for its initial public offering on Wall Street tomorrow. And not surprisingly, there is no Groupon deal for that. Shares will go for $20 apiece, which will value the company at more than $12 billion. So is stock in Groupon a good deal? For more, we're joined by Waylon Wong. She's a business reporter for the Chicago Tribune. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Waylon, first, how anticipated is this IPO?
This IPO has quite a lot of buzz on it. Certainly in Chicago, it's one of the most anticipated IPOs in years. And I think within the tech community, it's also gotten a very, very large amount of buzz and also controversy. And it's been a quiet few months for IPOs in general. So people are really concentrating on this one.
Waylon, a Groupon was offered, $6 billion from Google just a few months ago. Google offered to buy the company. They, of course, rejected that. Since that time, Groupon has had some pretty big setbacks, right?
Yeah, the 5 months or so since Groupon announced its intention to go public have been a little bit rocky. They had some issues with what the SEC calls the quiet period in which the company is not supposed to be commenting on its business, et cetera, while it waits to go public. And in one kind of big misstep, the CEO of Groupon, Andrew Mason, issued a pretty long and feisty internal memo to employees defending the business from its critics. And that was almost instantaneously leaked to the press. And so they had to kind of adjust their SEC documents to account for that particular disclosure, and they've been revising their documents to reflect kind of new accounting methodologies that have slashed their revenues, and in the meantime have attracted a fair amount of criticism for their business model.
So what were those accounting issues?
Groupon was using a figure for revenues that was actually the total amount that they collect for Groupon. So, for example, when Groupon sells a coupon for $10, it usually splits that with the merchant. So, for simplicity's sake, we can say Groupon takes $5, the merchant takes $5. Well, Groupon was counting the $10 as revenue when it should have been counting the $5. And so they had to revise their documents to reflect that. And when they did that, their revenues fell by quite a bit, almost 50%.
Waylon, there are some good questions being asked about Groupon's business model. Some argue this is easily replicated.
It's true. I mean, Groupon's business model has virtually no barriers to entry. You need someone making sales calls, and you need a website that is set up to handle credit card processing and online payments, and that's pretty simple. And that's why you've seen hundreds of Groupon clones pop up overnight after Groupon launched.
And its biggest competitors are Living Social, and even Amazon has jumped into this game.
Yeah, Groupon faces quite a few competitors. Today, Google, which is now doing local offers of its own, actually had a national deal for REI, the outdoor outfitters.
Oh, and that was today,
That was today, and that has sold thousands, even just in a few hours. And so when you've got someone with the muscle of Google coming in, you really have to pay attention.
If all of these big companies are getting into this game, how is it that Groupon could potentially be valued at $12 billion tomorrow?
You know, Groupon would argue that its business model is actually getting harder to replicate and that it's now doing quite a lot on the technology front that is going to kind of revolutionize e-commerce. It believes that it can be kind of the Amazon of local commerce and local advertising, and that not only can it help local merchants with getting people, new customers in the door through discounts, but that can also develop programs like loyalty programs for merchants so that they keep and retain those customers.
That's Waylon Wong. She's a business reporter for the Chicago Tribune, talking about tomorrow's IPO of Groupon. That's the Daily Deal website. Waylon, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I'm Michelle Martin, and this is Tell Me More from NPR News. Coming up, do you bring home the bacon or leave it at the store? We're going to let you in on one of those behind-closed-doors controversies that people often don't talk about. It's about pork. It turns out that the question of whether to consume the other white meat can be surprisingly divisive, especially among African Americans. We'll tell you why in a few minutes. But first, who's ready to fight over $5? Well, it turns out that thousands of customers were willing to fight their banks when some announced new fees for shopping with debit cards. Many people canceled their accounts, and one 22-year-old college graduate decided to go further, actually 300,000 steps further. Bank of America customer Molly Catchpole collected 300,000 supporters through an online petition asking the bank to rethink its plans. After the public outcry, Bank of America announced it would not impose the debit card fee after all. And Molly Catchpole joins us now in our Washington, D.C. studio. Welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
You know, how did you get the idea for this? I know a lot of people were mad because this is the kind of thing that, you know, it didn't take much to tap into the outrage, you know, over this. It was the kind of thing people really literally were talking about over the water cooler. But you actually decided to take it a step further and do something about it.
Well, I'd signed change.org petitions before. And, you know, social media is something that I'm really interested in. And, you know, I'm living paycheck to paycheck. And I just felt like something needed to be done. And so I wrote up the petition and I put it up on change.org and it went viral. You know, I mean, people, it went crazy. And people just started signing it, passing it around. I put it up on Twitter, and I think it made its rounds there. So within a couple of days, it had tens of thousands of signatures.
And you took it to Bank of America personally? Did you take it to your local branch?
I did. I took it downtown at 18th and K, and I handed them 155,000 signatures. At that point, it had been up for a little less than a week, I think. Yeah.
A week,
yeah.
And then what happened? Did someone actually take it from you, or what? How did that work?
It was kind of funny because I went in to close my account, and I had this big box full of paper, and I handed it to them, and they didn't quite know what to do. They were like, oh, okay, well, thank you. You know, we'll make sure this gets to somebody. And, you know, I don't know if they did. I hope they did. But I think they were a little bit taken aback by it.
Was it hard to come to the decision to close your account yourself?
No.
Because we were talking about this earlier. In fact, there were articles written about this. A lot of people said, you know what, I'm closing my account. And then when they thought about it and, you know, terminating their online bill payment arrangements and all that, a lot of people just didn't.
Yeah.
So was it hard? Was it a hard decision for you?
I think because I'm so young, I had only been with them for 3 years, so it was fairly easy. I was a little bit worried about I had just paid my rent. I had to pay an electricity bill and a cable bill, and I was a little bit worried that those would bounce. But, you know, I mean, luckily my student loans haven't kicked in yet, so I didn't have those, but it turned out being fine.
Were they nice about it when you talked to them about it, or were they, you know, there's this ad that I don't want to say the name of the particular bank company, but that a lot of people have been talking a lot about the customer service that a lot of people feel that they're getting, or the lack thereof, and that there's this one commercial for one financial institution where the people show up and try to talk to somebody at the bank, and the guy standing out front just kind of laughs in their face. And so were they nice to you about it when you tried to talk to somebody about your feelings about the fee? Or?
They were. They were very cordial when I went to close my account.
Okay. Say, shoo-shoo. Yeah. Well, so did you think that was going to end it there? Did you actually think you were going to win, is I guess what I'm wondering.
I know. People keep asking me that. I don't know what I was thinking. We had one victory last week when a bunch of the big banks said that they weren't going to charge the fee. And then Bank of America said that they would be refining their fee structure. And so that was one victory. And that was really exciting. And then a couple of days later, they announced that they were just stepping down entirely. And I don't know if I was expecting it. I mean, people keep asking me that, and I don't have an answer because I don't know what I was thinking. We were just kind of like going along with it, and, you know, oh, this is exciting, you know. I was hoping that it would work, and it did.
I'm interested in your response to the comment by Bank of America CEO Brian Moynihan, who said after the news of this fee went public, or this proposed fee went public, and there was an initial flurry of outrage, including from members of Congress, and he said that they have a right to make a profit and that they needed this fee in order to make up from profits lost because of regulatory changes imposed by Congress to bring down, you know, other fees, you know, for example, overdraft fees, which were quite large, and to bring those down. So what do you say to that?
Well, customers have a right to protest when they're unhappy about something. And from what we could see, you know, Bank of America didn't present us with any numbers when they announced it. You know, they didn't say specifically, this is how much money we've lost because of these regulations. They didn't say that. They just said it's going to be a $5 fee. And I think people haven't been protesting enough when they're unhappy about something. And I just kind of felt like that needed to happen. And so we absolutely have a right to protest when we're unhappy about something. And I thought his response was a little bit flippant. But you know, we kind of came back with it.
It's $5 a month, by the way, was the argument. The $5 a month was for people who chose to use their debit cards to make purchases in lieu of, say, a credit card instead of using it to withdraw cash. And so what is it about that you think kind of just struck a nerve? People spend $5 on a lot of things. Like there's a sandwich you can get, you know, for I'm not going to call it company name, but there's a sandwich you can get for $5. It seems to be rather popular. I'm sure that you know, you and I are both enjoying some coffee right now, and, you know, that can be $5. And I bet you people buy more than one of those a month. So what is it about that you think just...
you know, it's not always easy to get to an ATM to withdraw cash. I live a couple of stops away from the nearest Bank of America branch. And, you know, if you're really busy, I think it's easy to use your debit card. And also, there's a lot of bills I have to pay. There's a lot of fees we constantly have to keep up with every single month. And this was just kind of like the last straw.
Molly Catchpole is a recent college graduate. She scored a victory when her online petition went viral and is now credited with causing Bank of America and other institutions to back off from that proposed $5 a month debit card fee. She joined us in our Washington, D.C. studios. Molly, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Michelle.